Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisker in Financial Survival. Our guest tonight is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. James has been publishing the Corbett Report since 2007, if I recall correctly. He writes from Japan most of the time and recently visited Canada. And I went to your blog and I see that you have, you kind of disagree with Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz when she's saying there's no place like home, there's no place like home, there's no place like home. I saw that you described Canada, your home country, as now a tin pot dictatorship. Would you care to elaborate?
I certainly would. Well, I should state that I don't think Canada is quite unique in that situation, and it's not that I think Japan is notably better, maybe just in different ways, different strengths and weaknesses. But yes, I mean, I have known for a very long time that Canada portrays itself and likes to think of itself as some warm, fuzzy socialist utopia, but unfortunately has all of the hallmarks of strongly controlled collectivist socialist government, like hate speech laws, which, I mean, I think Americans are starting to understand what censorship is about and what it means, but I still don't think Americans really appreciate the First Amendment and what it's done for holding off the wolves that want to bite at the lap of freedom and have always been there, but have been stayed off to some degree. But in Canada and other countries around the world with these hate speech laws and human rights tribunals and things, it does enter this situation where, as is being found out by one Canadian journalist at the moment, for merely calling a government agency, if you can even call it that, the Alberta Human Rights Commission, crazy. That's what he wrote. He wrote a column, I think a year ago, where he called it crazy. He's now being prosecuted by the Alberta Law Society for daring to question the wisdom of such an august government institution. And unfortunately, that's only one of many, many such cases of free speech in Canada not really existing if the government says it doesn't exist. And as I point out in that video that you're referencing, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is a wonderful sounding document with all of these wonderful rights, like the right to freedom of expression and right to freedom of press. But the very first clause of that charter is, these rights are only subject to such limitations as is reasonable in a just and democratic society, i.e. whatever the government says they can do. And they can say, well, that's a reasonable limitation on your freedom. So that's exactly what happens. That's why there are hate speech laws in the criminal code in Canada. And that's why people don't really have freedom of speech in Canada.
Do you think Donald Trump could run for office? Public office
he would be prosecuted so quickly. Oh, absolutely not. That would be unimaginable in the Canadian climate. There's just no way that could happen.
One of the things that amazed me, I was very much surprised to see one of the video excerpts that were included in your video was some little guy who's confronting three police officers somewhere in Canada, down one of the main cities. And they tell him, he's trying to say, well, don't I have the right of free speech in Canada? And they're telling him, you're not in Canada. And he says, what? I'm not in Canada. And he half laughs at him. And the police are telling him, no, you're not in Canada. Now, this is interesting to me because I've observed certain evidence. I can't say it's proof, but I've seen evidence that I think is persuasive, it's certainly interesting, that Texas is now deemed to be a territory by the government of the United States rather than a state of the Union. And this guy's comment, he said, we're not in Texas. The police told him, we're not in Canada anymore. Did that ring your bell? Did I see more there than was really the case?
Oh, no, not at all. That really, I mean, there was a sense in which that was literally meant by the police officer who said it in his official capacity as a police officer in the line of duty. And just for the context of that video, that was taken at the Toronto G20 back in 2010, where there were, I mean, 1,100 people were ultimately arrested over the course of that G20. And that's the one where there's that iconic image of the burning police car, because the police roll this car into the midst of a protest, and then suddenly all of these masked black bloc protesters appear, start demolishing the car, and then set it on fire. And of course, that becomes the iconic image of the Toronto G20. And of course, the next day, of course, the police go and arrest everyone, anyone, anyone who's protesting in any way. So it was very much, I think, a false flag that was used to justify the police crackdown, as we saw at the battle in Seattle in 2000 and many other places besides. But just par for the course in Canada, unfortunately, we saw a very similar incident at the 2007 protests against the SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership in Montebello, where admittedly Quebec provincial police dressed up as protesters and then walked towards the police line with rocks in their hands, intending to start a fight that would allow the police crackdown. But luckily, one very sharp-eyed protester physically stopped them, and wouldn't allow them to go near the line. Ultimately, they get quote-unquote arrested, but pictures get taken during the arrest showing the exact same boots with the exact same treads on the quote-unquote protesters and the actual police. It becomes a national news story, and eventually the Quebec police have to admit, yes, they were actually police officers. So this is the type of thing that goes on in Canada with some regularity, and it's happened in the United States and elsewhere besides. It's an old tactic. But in Toronto, I mean, not only was that going on, but they also set up this special perimeter around the G20 conference, which for some reason they held right in downtown Toronto, and they set up this security perimeter where only people who actually lived or worked in the area could go through, and only subject to random searches at the will of the police that were there, which of course is an absolute violation of Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which gives the right to freedom from unreasonable search and seizure and whatever, very much like the Bill of Rights. But they set up this special security perimeter where they said, basically, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms doesn't apply here. We can do what we want in this area. And that's exactly what they did.
Like a free speech zone.
Exactly.
For the United States,
exactly.
You can say whatever you want over there, about a half mile, that little fenced in area. Go over there and talk to yourself. Say anything you want. But out here in public, you can't. They've tried something similar. I think what you're helping people in the United States to understand is how important the First Amendment is. We take it for granted and we don't really think about it too much. Yeah, we got the right free speech. You're showing us that it really is an important right that is not available in Canada to the same degree that it is here in the United States, although I'm sure there are people working to try to restrict it.
Yes.
What do you think the future of free speech is here in the United States?
Oh, it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't look good. We'll put it that way. Obviously, the First Amendment is weakening and has been under attack for a very long time by, as I say, the forces that have always tried to nip at those freedoms and try to curtail them, because horrible, horrible freedom. Oh, no, people can say words, and words might hurt people and offend people. Unfortunately, as I'm sure people in the United States know by now, the sort of PC round two that's taking place right now is even worse than round one was a couple of decades ago. And now people are routinely losing their jobs for daring to state opinions and things of that nature. Of course, everyone always has to make the statement, it just because I'm defending someone's right to say something doesn't mean I agree with them. That's the exact point of something like the First Amendment. You don't agree with these things, but you allow people to say them, because it is only through speech that we can counter speech that we disagree with. It's not through putting people in charge of courts and governments that will come along and say what you can or cannot say. That is the very recipe, the very element, the bath in which tyranny is stewed. And that's exactly what's taking place increasingly in the United States. And I think we're going to see more and more with this crackdown on various types of internet speech in the name of going against bullying or threats of people online and that type of thing. We're going to see more and more intrusions on people's ability to express themselves. So I don't think the United States is immune to this by any degree. I just think that it's still, I think, a lot further ahead than places like Canada.
Your video also talked about the effects. It talked about the failure of Canadian journalists to stand up and ask the right questions. Or at least implied that. Do you think that Canadian journalism is pretty much controlled to a point where no one's really challenging the system right now? Are they intimidated to that degree and controlled, or just indifferent? what's happening to Canadian journalism?
Oh, it's exactly a parallel to what I think is happening in the United States. I mean, there's a concentration of media power in a very few hands, and some of the big media moguls in Canada are function exactly like the big media moguls in America, which is to be an adjunct to state power. And they may side with one or the other side of the phony left-right debates that, you know, maybe this issue will be highlighted this week, or that issue will be highlighted next week, or we'll support this candidate or that candidate, but they'll never, of course, fundamentally question the myths upon which our society is increasingly based, like the war on terror myth and all of these silly events that are being used to propagandize the Canadian people. That you know, it's a similar situation to the United States. And Canada, in fact, recently just passed an anti-terror bill called C-51 that's, I guess, analogous to the Patriot Act in that it really does fundamentally abrogate some of these supposed rights and freedoms that Canadians supposedly enjoy in the name of confronting this terror boogeyman. And that's exactly what I'm going to be writing about in this weekend's Forecaster.
When we see this media control and this attempt to restrict free speech, is this evidence that people are as easy to control as a bunch of Pavlovian dogs? And if we control the information they have and they can say, we can control them, we can change their perception of reality? Or is it ultimately kind of self-defeating in that you bottle them up, you won't let them say the truth, don't let them say the truth, don't let them say the truth until the truth explodes, perhaps violently, against the existing government? What do you think?
Well, that's the operative question, and that's the one that is being answered right now at this moment in time, especially, of course, with the advent of the online alternative media. It really is the chance to actually answer that question. We don't have to speculate about it. It is happening right now. And I would like to be on the side that believes that people cannot be controlled Pavlovian style like automatons, or at least not all of the people all of the time, and that enough people can actually act and think for themselves and snap out of their conditioning and start to question it. I really do obviously believe that. That's why I'm here doing what I do. That's why the Corbett Report exists. But it is not, I think, by any means a straightforward answer, and we are in the midst of it. And we know that for generations, there have been people who have devoted their entire lives to studying how best to condition human beings to act in certain ways. And this goes back to Skinner, B.F. Skinner, of course, in the United States, and people before him who have been researching this for a very long time about how best to condition people to accept whatever whatever situation they're placed into. And I think that we can. I think people like myself, yourself, the people who are listening to this program are living, breathing examples and testaments to the fact that we can snap out of that conditioning, that we are not just robots to be programmed. But the question is it enough? Is it enough? And can we do something in time to stave this off? Can we start to build up the alternative infrastructures? That, again, is the question that's on the table and that we're attempting to answer, you know, even with conversations like this one.
The scary thing about this is that you have to suppose that we're not the first people to consider these questions by any stretch of the imagination, and that includes the mainstream media. It includes the tin pot dictatorship. They've already asked these questions, and the fact that they are trying to control free speech in a way that's despotic suggests their research indicates, yep, we can condition these people just like a bunch of Pavlovian dogs, and those we can't, we'll deal with, we'll either endure, marginalize, or remove. The media's got to have answers to these. They've got to have research to suggest that they can get away with this.
I think they demonstrably do. And there's a couple of different things that I've talked about on my program that people can look into. One is the idea of learned helplessness, which is basically, long story short, the idea that people can be conditioned to accept that they are in a hopeless situation. Nothing you do will ever make any difference. So you basically lie down and just accept whatever is coming. Even if that's a lie, even if there is something you can do, you've just basically kind of given into it mentally. So there's nothing you can do about it. So that's one of the things that I think they rely on and are hoping for. And another that I've talked about is if people want an idea of the mindset behind the would-be social engineers, people who really believe they can program the human race to do what they want, read B.F. Skinner's Walden 2, which is a novel about this, you know, utopian society that they're attempting to create in which children are conditioned from birth to basically act in the ways that the, you know, would be best for society. And this is Skinner making the positive case, really. This would be a wonderful thing if we can condition all these children to accept this. Wouldn't it be wonderful? I think it's a nightmare. And I talked about that in a previous podcast of mine that people can look up on my website. Just type in Walden 2 in the search engine.
I think you're right. I think it is a nightmare. But let me ask you this. When we talk about people becoming increasingly, they can't believe that they're able to solve their own problems. They become increasingly dependent. To me, that at least implicates the welfare regime. What kind of welfare system do you have in Canada as compared to what exists in this country? And do you have a class of people that are just prepared to live without working in Canada? Or are they getting away with it?
More or less. I mean, I think, again, the social safety net is analogous, at least between the countries. But I think one of the major differences, and one that's often pointed out, of course, is the socialized healthcare in Canada, and which Canadians will absolutely stand by and will vociferously protest any hint of any type of privatization of that system, even though almost no one I've ever talked to has been happy with the type of service they receive in that healthcare system, waiting sometimes weeks or months or even years for elective surgeries or things like what's deemed to be elective and things of that nature. Because, of course, ultimately, the government, in combination with the healthcare providers, get to determine what is or is not necessary for you, rather than you being able to determine that yourself. Not that there's a free market in the United States, as you know, but there's at least more of private practice, which allows people to get care, which is why a lot of Canadians who can afford to do so do go down to the United States to get the care that they need. So that's one of the major glaring differences, and something that Canadians pride themselves on. But it is more of a socialist kind of state, and there are a lot more there's a lot more of that sense that the government is there to take care of you for, you know, your cradle
can't
to grave.
Take care of yourself.
That's the other side of it.
You cannot make it on your own. That's the dangers fought here from my perspective. Let's take a break for a couple of commercials, and James and I will be back in just a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Talk a little about gold. I think we might have touched on this last week. I don't recall clearly. My notion that the paper gold that we see in the vast majority of markets sets the price of gold from a perspective of a mere commodity. While people who purchase physical gold, like myself and gold bugs and so on, I believe that they tend to see gold as a monetary metal. We've got the paper gold, sets a commodity price, but the people who are buying physical gold see it as a monetary metal. There's just not a market at the moment to establish a monetary metal price. All right? Now, everyone understands, everyone listening to this program at least, understands that the system has been using paper gold as a means to manipulate the market price of gold and thereby suppress the price of physical gold. People, there is widespread belief that the markets are rigged, that they're manipulated. But what I'm wondering about, are these markets rigged on a national level? And if so, are they evidence of central planning for the United States? Or are they rigged on a global level? And if so, are they evidence of central planning for the world?
Bing, bing, bing. We have a winner.
Let's go. You run.
I definitely think there is. I mean, there's no doubt that there is manipulation from a lot of different corners of the globe. I guess the only question is to what extent that is coordinated. But one really interesting example happened just a week or two ago. You might remember that I think we talked about, at any rate, the Chinese central bank released its latest gold holdings figures for the IMF and showed that they gained 600 tons of gold in the month of June. Well, of course, they didn't gain it all in the month of June. They've been quietly stockpiling gold for the last six years since they last reported a jump in their gold holdings, and now they're finally allowing the figure to increase by 600 tons. Who knows how much they actually have, but they're saying it's about 1,600 tons right now. But, so they did that on a Friday. Now, I think there's a couple of different reasons they did that, one of which is, of course, they are angling to get included in the yuan included in the SDR, the special drawing rights basket, so you know, they have to show that there's some strength, some punch to this currency, and that it's not just, a paper dragon. That obviously puts them in a slightly better position, and I think even more assures that the yuan will be included in the special drawing rights basket. On top of that, I think it's also a way of showing the markets that they're desperately trying to backstop right now, and beginning to fail again, interestingly enough, that they have firepower to back up what they're doing with in the Chinese stock market. But regardless, by increasing their holdings by 600 tons in 1 month, that is going to have an upward effect on the price of gold, all things being equal. But not all things are equal. So if you're the central bank of China and you just admit you have to, you're kind of painted in this corner, you have to admit you have more gold than you were saying. You maybe don't open the kimono all the way, but you admit you've got 600 more tons. That's going to have an upward effect. That's going to prevent you from being able to buy as much gold as you would otherwise be able to buy in the future. How do you counteract that effect? Well, interestingly, so that was done on Friday, July 17th. On Monday the 20th, there was a two-minute window on the Shanghai Gold Exchange where five tons of gold was dumped into the market. And just to put that in perspective, usually in an entire day's worth of trading, 25 tons are traded. So 5 tons in 2 minutes. And what effect did that have on the price of gold? Of course, it crashed it. $43 down on the day, 3.8% down to 1,087 on July 20th. So dumping 5 tons into the markets in 2 minutes can cause a $43 an ounce plunge in the price of gold, 3.8% savings, basically discount. So you can announce 600 tons of gold, but you dump 5 tons of gold into the market and you get a big discount on future buying. So I think there are these types of manipulations that are taking place all around the globe for different reasons from different players, including the central banks that, of course, like China and Russia, are secretly stocking up behind the scenes and want to make sure that price remains low. And of course, the US wants to make sure the price remains low because it's the smokescreen behind which they can inflate the dollar away into infinity. So there's a lot of different players at the table, but there's no doubt that gold is being manipulated internationally at this point.
From another perspective, when we see this market manipulation, is that merely evidence of pockets of greed, which you're implying to some degree with your analysis? Is it just pockets of greed and criminal activity? We got a bunch of crooks in this country that are manipulating the market, and a bunch of crooks in China, and a bunch of crooks wherever. And the crooks are all, it's like, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. It's not everybody doesn't take orders from Willie Sutton, but we do follow the principle. We rob the banks because that's what. All right, are we looking at criminal conduct when we see this market manipulation, or again, is this market manipulation on a global scale? Is it evidence of central planning by a world government whose powers are not yet obvious? You know, we talk about the New World Order, but people tend to think of it as something at some point in the future. It's not here yet. It's in the planning stage. Is it already controlling markets right now?
To some extent, I would say yes. And I think that power is growing. And I think it's not quite where the people behind that agenda would like it to be. But it's important to understand that you ask the question as an or question. So is it greed, yep, or is it a global agenda? And those are not mutually exclusive ideas. I think we have to understand this as an onion with layers. And the outside layers are the ones that are obvious to most people and easily understandable. Yes, there's personal greed, and I guess even national greed in a way. You could explain it in those ways. And that does line up with some of the players here and their actions. There are clearly people who are manipulating the markets for their own personal gain or the gain of their companies or what have you. That does take place. But I think as you peel back those layers and you look further in, I think there is an agenda to that, not just some, you know, every mad dash for himself, everyone just taking what they can. Because again, when you get into the inner layers of the onion and you start talking about people further up the financial pyramid, again, money isn't fundamentally important to these people. It's power. And the money is just the way you measure. You know, it's whatever Gordon Gekko said in Wall Street. It's dollars are just points. It's how you judge who wins the game or something like that. And to a certain extent, I think that that is a more accurate reflection of what's going on here. It's not about the accumulation of dollars and cents, certainly, because again, those are just, you know, fiat manipulations themselves. It's about the power that this gives certain people over certain things. So, for example, if you look at the gold situation specifically, as I was saying with China angling to get into the SDR basket, again, you can read that on a simple level of, oh, here's a national authority that wants to get its national currency as part of the sort of, you know, world reserve basket so that it can have a stronger position nationally. But I think there's a deeper agenda behind that. And the reason why China cooperates with the IMF, even though it pretends to feud with them, with the AIIB and institutions like that, is that ultimately there are certain players who want to use these types of international institutions to create the framework for world government and a global currency. How do you do that? Well, you have to have something to take the place of the US dollar. So it has to be built up by players like China and others through the SDR. So I think there is a way in which the global agenda that's really at the core of this onion can be seen to be compatible with and in some ways use the greed and sort of baser instincts of the people on the outside of this agenda.
You've been in Japan for, I think, 11 years now. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah, this is my 11th year.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And have you visited China?
I have on three occasions, once mainland China, once Taiwan, and once Hong Kong.
I know a lady who went to there, lived there for a year one time. And she told me a story that she had a guide. They assigned a guide to her to take her around. She was in Peking. And they assigned a guide to take her around and here, there, wherever. But she noticed that the guide would never take her to a local restaurant. It was just, you know, on the same block where she had her apartment. And she'd never take her to the restaurant. And she finally, and they said, why not? She asked her why, and the guide gave her some nonsensical explanation. And she pushed the guide until the guide finally admitted, well, they serve dog and cat there. All right? And she knows, she says, we know how you Americans are about having pets, and I didn't want to take you to a restaurant. Now, the point to this is Donna's told me, the lady's name was Donna, she said that people in China routinely lie. It's part of the culture. It's accepted that you tell lies in order to maintain harmony, right? You don't want to upset anybody, so you tell them whatever they want to hear. And I heard one report that the premier of China, he was complaining that he couldn't even count on the economic reports he was getting from the provinces because he knew the people running the provinces would be lying to him. Now, I'm curious whether you've seen or you're aware of China being prone to telling lies. Is that something that you're aware of in their culture, or is that something that Donna was mistaken about?
Yes. Well, when you start talking culturally, it gets sort of vague and amorphous. But generally speaking, people note that Asia is, generally speaking, the Asian cultures are concerned about saving face and the idea of, you know, face and honor and that type of thing. So people will tell lies in order to maintain harmony, and certainly that happens in Japan, and they even have names for that, Honmae and Tatemae, what you present to the outside world versus what you really think, and things like that. That's really part of the fabric of Asian society, generally speaking, to the extent that you can generalize. And yes, I mean, there's no doubt that in China, certainly from a business perspective, I think it's quite well known that Chinese business leaders tend to be the most ruthless people who will do what they can to get whatever they can as they can, and, you know, to hell with the consequences, basically. And we've seen that in a number of different ways from all of the scandals that come out about melamine in the milk and other such scandals, lead paints and things that obviously are done to cut corners and to basically sell products. And I think that is, to some extent, yes, that is a cultural thing to some extent. It's just a question of kind of a nouveau riche that's coming into vogue in China. There's some upward mobility of certain business class, and these people are just going to take advantage of that while they can, or that's their sort of attitude. So I think there's a number of historical and cultural and other factors that go into that. But yes, I think that's part of what's going on. And you point to the idea, I mean, I think the most blatant of this is in the Chinese statistics. And if you look at, for example, the GDP figures, we just saw the GDP quarterly GDP results for Q2 in 2015. It's bang, wouldn't you know it, bang on the nose, 7.0%, the exact growth figure that the Chinese government is looking for. The second quarter in a row that that's happened, and the umpteenth quarter in a row where it's been at least 7%. And what does that number mean? Absolutely nothing. As you point out, even the current premier of the Chinese government, Li Keqiang, when he was the head of the Communist Party in Liaoning, he admitted off the record to an embassy official and the ambassador to China, Clark Grant, at the time, back in 2007, that, you know what, these GDP statistics are man-made, they're for reference only, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we don't actually use them in our own work. And he, at that time, this is all because of a leaked diplomatic cable that came out, so that we now know about this. But basically, in 2007, he was saying that there were three things that he looked at in order to actually calculate the real GDP growth for Liaoning back when he was the head of the Chinese Communist Party there: electricity consumption, rail cargo volume, and bank lending, because those are statistics that are kept rather reliably. And when you put those together, you get a much better idea of what the economy really looks like. And wouldn't you know it, actually, it's interestingly enough, in the latest statistics coming out of China, electricity consumption, rail cargo volume, and bank lending are all significantly down in the last few quarters. So I think in reality, I think everyone knows China is starting to grind to a halt, whatever their GDP figures are actually saying.
I'm wondering to myself, do I want to ride an airplane where the guy that torqued the bolts on the wings is raised in a culture where lying is permissible? I mean, did he probably say, oh, yeah, I torqued the bolts to maintain harmony rather than actually torquing the bolts? And more question, we've got maybe just 45 seconds left. Can a society that is substantially built on lies, can it expect to hold an economy together? Won't those lies ultimately tear it apart? We've got about 30 seconds.
Right. Well, I think this is less of a cultural question, because I don't want to say all Chinese are liars or anything of that sort, but I think it's the economic political situation. It has to do with the Chinese Communist Party, the collectivization, the control of speech and everything else that goes on in China. And I think that fundamental manipulation, like what we're seeing in the stock market, shows that this is not, it's craziness. It's insanity. It's held together by spit and good wishes, if that even. So it's going to fall apart at the seams.
Yeah, that's the problem. All right, James, I want to thank you for being on the program. As always, look forward to talking to you again next week. That's James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night.